listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, author and historian Kevin Baker thinks that America is a pretty creative place, especially for a young country. He shares a lot of fascinating examples in his new book, America the Ingenious.
First, Larry Miller has been a friendly and familiar voice on WPR's airwaves for 50 years. That's half of the network's 100 years that we are celebrating this year.
Larry has seen a lot and done a lot in those years, and his accomplishments were honored by the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association when they inducted him into their Hall of Fame last month. I sat down with Larry recently to talk about his career.
Let's go back to where your career started on the air. It's 1967. We're in the throes of the Vietnam War. Lyndon B. Johnson is president. And how does your radio career unfold in 1967?
Well, I was a graduate student in the Department of Agricultural Journalism. Actually, I was an undergraduate student. And I took a course in radio from Maury White in my senior year. Maury was going to Colorado for the summer and needed someone to do his half-hour radio show. So he said, how would you like to go on for a master's degree? And then you could do my radio show for me and get your master's. And I didn't have any job prospects. So I said, well, that sounds interesting. Sounds like a good idea. I had been an animal science with a business option student. That was where my major was going. And my goal in life at that time was to be a marketing guy for Oscar Mayer.
So you were taking over for Maury, who was doing the farm report.
He was doing the half-hour farm report. And this goes back, agricultural journalism and public radio go all the way back to the beginning of public radio. There's been that tie there. Where we've, under an arrangement, we provided agricultural information and consumer home economics type information. So we had two different programs at that time. I said, sure, I'll go on for master's. So I wasn't very good, to be perfectly honest. But I went to Carl Schmidt. Carl was the head guy then. And I said, Carl, I'm not doing very well. Can you help me out? And he said, well, you're the first one that ever asked me for help. So he assigned a guy by the name of Ken Ost. And Ken listened to me and gave me some tips and really helped out. And I started sounding better.
What kind of tips did he give you?
I was being too precise. And I wanted to sound like the public radio sound. And he said, no, be yourself more. So you need to loosen up a little bit. So I did, and made a difference, I think, in how I performed on the air.
It's interesting to hear you say that public radio had a certain sound. You know, this is back in the late 60s, early 70s. This is at the inception of NPR, and you really still thought it had a certain way, a certain sound.
You know, we didn't have two sort of systems going on at the time. So everything was on. There was a little classical music, and then there'd be some news, and then there'd be the homemakers show, and then there might be the farm show, and then there might be some classical music. So it was all together. And there were lots of lectures. We would run lectures with, some of the great lectures of this campus, which they were interesting. But the format was, I thought it was a little more stilted, maybe, than the way I like to do things. So I kind of stuck out. I was a little bit of a sore thumb, I think, for some people.
A decade goes by, and you have this new program, Wisconsin Here and Now, and you started taking callers in 1978. It was the first daily call-in show for the network. What was that like to add listener voices to the program?
It was really a lot of fun. Jack Mitchell had come to me prior to that and said, hey, I'm thinking about doing a call-in talk show, and I'd like to have you do one. If you were going to do one, what kinds of things would you cover and do? And I thought about that overnight, and I came back the next day and I said, you know, I'd like to do, I'm kind of an advice guy. I've got that extension background. And so things about people's health, gardening could be a great topic, the environment and outdoors. And he said, well, that's exactly what I was hoping you'd say. And it was really a lot of fun. I was so looking forward to getting all those voices. We'd done some research, frankly, on a call-in format versus a straight interview format. And frankly, the research showed that the call-in format, even though it was not at all organized, frankly, people liked that a lot better.
Do you remember that first call you received?
Yeah, I actually do. I had the first show that I did was I had two veterinarians on, and we were talking about pet health and so forth and answering any questions that people might have. And so I'm wondering if anybody's going to call at all. And Grace Pearson, who subsequently, later, she called many, many times. She was from Stevens Point, Wisconsin. And I'm waiting for that question, and she says, how do I tell if my cat is a male or a female? And the vet said, well, you pick up its tail. That was the first question. And we're kind of off and running from there and just having a lot of fun, but I think also getting a lot of pretty good information out to people.
You've been described as the friendly host who has kitchen table conversations. Do you see yourself that way?
Yeah, I think so. I'm more or less off air the way I am on the air. I'm curious about things. I don't think I'm pretentious at all. I, you know, was raised to be respectful to people, and I think I'm respectful to my audience. And when they ask questions, I think I'm polite about that. People seem to like that a lot.
On Fridays, you host Garden Talk, and clearly you know a lot about gardening. You can answer many questions, even when your guest expert sometimes doesn't know the answer. How do you know so much about gardening?
Well, you know, when I was as an undergraduate in animal science, I had to take a lot of plant science courses as part of that. So I did take some horticulture and agronomy classes, botany. So I learned a bit there. But frankly, most of what I learned on my own show, just listening to the guests that I had and also the listeners, because many of the listeners know a whole lot more than I know about gardening. If you're paying attention to your own show, you're going to pick up things over time. And
when you don't know the answer to a gardening question, when you're stumped, you often refer people to go to Extension, look up something through Extension online. And I always think, you know what, that harkens back to the roots of his career and the roots of the show.
Yeah, and you know, those early interviews that we did were pretty much mostly Extension faculty members, men and women who were in Extension. You know, I was inculcated into Extension, you know, really early in my life. I got an award once from Extension, a service award, and I said, well, I didn't get involved with Extension until I was seven. So I started in 4-H. You know, I had a lot of training there. In 4-H, you learn how to speak in front of people. You learn how to make booths and exhibits that, you know, people are going to like. And so that whole business of sharing what you know and getting information about what others know out to our publics, that was a pretty strong influence on me.
Going back to those early days, you went to Hope School in Dane County?
Yeah, I went to a one-room schoolhouse the first six grades. Eleanor Dahl was the teacher, and she was an absolutely wonderful teacher. And I think some of my own teaching, I patterned myself after some of the things that Eleanor was good at. So there were three of us in my class, so Roger Korfmacher, Betty Leonard, and me. It was a fun class. It was a fun school to go to because you'd, you know, each grade would have to come up to the front and sit with a teacher, and you'd always listen to what the other school, the other grades had. You learned a whole lot just listening to what, you know, when you're a third grader, listening to what the fourth graders or the fifth graders were talking about. And it was really a wonderful time. And then school consolidation happened. So I went to Cottage Grove grade school. And what a big change there, because there was a grade in every classroom.
We're talking with WPR host Larry Mueller about his first 50 years on the air. Stay tuned for more of the conversation here on Central Time. We're visiting with Larry Mueller and talking about his 50-year career with WPR. Larry was recently inducted into the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association's Hall of Fame. You went on to get a doctorate. What's your doctorate in?
My doctorate's in mass communications, and it goes back to actually this whole business of accidentally getting into radio, because I went to do my master's degree, as you remember, and as I was about three quarters of the way through my master's degree, Maury White got a promotion to a deanship. And so then the Department of Agricultural Journalism began searching for another PhD person to fill Maury's shoes. And because of the timing, they say, you know what, we're not going to be able to get this done this year. Would you be willing to stay on now after your master's degree for a year and do the show and teach the class and that sort of thing? And I still didn't have any jobs prospects. So I said, well, sure. And so I stayed on. And then I think I made a kind of a big jump in terms of my own abilities on the air. And I know the department was really after a particular person. And in the end, he turned them down. And then they said, you know what, why don't you go on for a PhD and we'll hire you back. That would never happen today. But that'd be great. So I did my PhD. I was fortunate enough to get a fellowship that covered 4 years.
So you could continue doing the show, but you could also be Larry the Scholar.
Yeah.
Was there a difference between going after your doctorate and doing the scholarly work versus, you know, the very practical side of producing a radio show each day? Was there a difference between those two worlds?
Well, there was, although the research that I was involved in was community development research. How do you get planning for change in a community, and how do you get citizen input into the planning process? So, frankly, the public input is something that has always been sort of near and dear to me, which is why the call-in shows are so important to me. Following that, actually, when I finished my PhD, I worked with another faculty member, and we did community development studies and work in probably about 40 communities around Wisconsin. So I actually continued the research while I was also on-air host. And then I taught classes and advised students. So
WPR Next is exploring where programming heads in the future. What words of wisdom would you give to WPR for envisioning new programming?
You know, in the radio classes I teach, I talk to the students about who's your audience. What are your audience's needs? What are your audiences like? Are there things that you can do to pique their interest and have fun and educate them at the same time? We never talk about education on Wisconsin Public Radio, but we hope that's what we're doing, you know. So it's the Larry Mueller Show or Conversations with Larry Mueller, things like that. But what we're really in the business of doing is providing great information from respected sources that people can use in their everyday lives. Now, it's very, very hard to make a show that is going to appeal to everybody. So think about your audience and then look at exciting ways that you can attract them and help them out, educate them.
Speaking of audience, you've hosted Santa and one of his elves on the program. And is this a tradition? When did it start?
It started, oh my goodness, it was a long time. I can't even tell you the date, to be perfectly honest, but it has been years and years and years. Jim Fleming did it first. And I think Jim, we were trying to get a voice, a deeper or more hollow voice. And Jim has a great voice, but he thought, oh, I'll stick my head in one of the trash cans. Well, we didn't get a new one. And so he was talking in the and this one that had kind of an off, it was pretty bad. But we've been doing it for years and years and years, and it's so much fun to hear those kids.
What was it like to work for WPR going way, way back decades ago? Tell us about what the environment was like here.
We were in Old Radio Hall, which is just a small building. Because of my position, I would be in the Department of Ag Journalism, and then later, it's called Life Sciences Communication now, but I would prepare my show, get my tapes together, and then I'd come over, and I would bring my 5-inch reel-to-reel tapes with my two interviews with an open and close queue on each one for the engineer. And we were not set up or even allowed to run the boards ourselves. So there was an engineer and I'd give him the tapes and we'd sit down and he would give me a point or she. We had both men and women doing that. And so you sit in front of the microphone and talk into it when they told you. And there was a cough button that we had. If we had to cough, you hit the cough button. So it was a much smaller staff, but some really, really good people. I mean, Carl Schmidt and Ken Ost and people like Cliff Roberts, people like that were just very professional, wonderful on-air people. And I looked up to every one of them.
Did you receive some good advice along the way that's stuck with you?
Well, mostly Ken's advice, I think, was be prepared. Ken says, Louis Pasteur always said, chance favors the prepared mind. So you be prepared, know what you're doing, but then be yourself. Be interested in what you're talking about and make sure that comes across when you're talking into the microphone. Once, a long time ago, I was interviewing a person who was supposed to talk about how to deal with stress. And so I had read some things on it beforehand, and she was quite good beforehand. We got her in the studio, and then I asked her the first question, and she kind of stressed out herself, and her mouth opened, and nothing came out. So I said, you know, before you answer that question, let me take a crack at that. And so I answered my own question, and then I asked her another one, and I actually answered that one. And then somebody had already called and asked a question, and I sort of answered their question. And at that point, something finally clicked with her. And, you know, then she was fine the rest of the show. And over the next 4 or 5 days, I got a lot of mail on it. And the gist of every one of the comments was, why don't you let your guests do the talking? Why are you answering those questions?
You can't win, Larry.
But it's, you know, it does go to being prepared.
If you could change anything, do you have any regrets or is there anything that you would have changed along the way?
I don't think so. I've had so much luck, you know, and just to get into broadcasting in the first place, I kind of fell into it. And then to have so much help from people over the years to help me and improve, and then the guests that I've had, I don't think well, there might be a few guests. But for the most part, I wouldn't change a thing.
How have you given back and left your mark in broadcasting?
I've been able to pass on a lot of great information, not things that I necessarily knew, but what my guests knew to people. And I think my goal has always been to have fun and have our listeners have fun, but also have them learn something. And I think of anything I've done, I think I've been able to pass on a fair amount of learning.
Larry Mueller, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Host Larry Mueller has been on the WPR airwaves for 50 years and was recently inducted into the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association's Hall of Fame. You can watch a video celebrating his career over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Donna Fisher grew up on a farm. Though she doesn't live on a farm now, growing and preserving fruit for winter connects her to her heritage.
Like clockwork, my backyard raspberry patch erupts with fruit every year right after the 4th of July. As long as there is enough rain in June, this crop can be counted on, and so my obligation to glean the berries begins. Every evening, I can be found out there, wading into the unruly thicket of wispy stems, cup in my right hand, picking with my left. I enjoy fresh raspberries for almost an entire month, and put away what I can't eat fresh into my basement freezer. January's morning oatmeal will be covered in July's produce, an unrivaled treat. By picking berries, I am carrying on what my folks and their folks before them did every summer. Growing up on a farm in Wisconsin meant that you maintained a large garden and preserved any fruit available from your orchard. My mother made and canned our own applesauce, as well as pears and plums. She froze strawberries and raspberries. Buckets of cherries from Door County and crates of peaches from Colorado were also canned, assuring that our hearty breakfast meals would have luscious variety, even in the winter. Preserving fruit was commonly called putting by for the winter, but now the notion seems slightly archaic. With 24-hour supermarkets offering countless varieties of fruits and vegetables, in or out of season, what need is there to pick your own? I know the practice isn't entirely out of fashion, but I know so few who care to do this. Now, when I mention the idea of fruit for breakfast to my friends, I find that it's not something that many grew up with. Preserving raspberries from my backyard in Green Bay is all that I have left of my farming roots. The small raspberry plants that I took from my folks' farm 5 or 6 years ago have boldly taken hold in my garden, so much so that I now have scarcely enough room for anything else. These hardy descendants of my mother's raspberry patch ask so little of me. I never prune nor fertilize. I just show up to steal fruit. As I pick a seemingly endless array of juicy berries, I wonder where to send the thank you card. Surely, the earth is under no obligation to bring forth such fruit every summer. And I wonder if my mother knows that I'm taking fruit from the plants derived from those she once raised. Like her, the raspberries just give and give and ask for so little in return.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Coming up, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then American inventors have given us many of the most useful but often overlooked tools and gadgets that we use every day. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Stay with us here on Central Time.
Author and historian Kevin Baker thinks that America is a pretty creative place, especially for a relatively young country. He shares a lot of fascinating examples and the stories behind them in his book, America the Ingenious. Kevin, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So you say in your book that America is an unusually inventive nation, and you list several factors you think makes that the case. One is a very broad one. It's freedom. And what do you mean by that?
I mean the ability of people in America to both go out on their own and try to come up and with anything they can and invent it, and also the ability to get their voices heard about really good ideas. Jesse Hawley, for instance, was an upstate New York flower merchant with really a Little Red Schoolhouse education, but who ended up in debtor's prison in Geneva, New York, because he could not get his goods to market in time. He came up with the idea of the Erie Canal that revolutionized where America's place in the world. People like that, and also people such as A.P. Giannini, the investment banker in San Francisco, who started the Bank of America and who really helped put through the Golden Gate Bridge, along with many other great additions to the Bay Area's infrastructure, or William Ogden, who basically saw the opportunity that Chicago's location provided and built that town almost by himself in the beginning.
And you also say, and this might be surprising to some people, that government involvement is crucial.
Government is absolutely crucial. Government has played many key roles in American invention, and it does that through a number of things. For one fact is, in one way, is that it arbitrates. Government patent rules and government court rulings have been absolutely crucial in ending what would have been otherwise endless fights over just who invented the cotton gin, the sewing machine, the telephone, the telegraph, the phonograph, the television. These fights would have gone on and on. Government made the decisions about who deserved what credit. They saved terrific grassroots American inventors such as Philo Farnsworth, who invented electronic TV, from having his invention stolen by David Sarnoff and RCA. Raymond Damadian, who came up with the MRI. They saved GE from simply stealing that from him. Government also regulates in terms of doing things like antitrust, which has been a tremendous spur to invention. AT&T, William Shockley's team at AT&T came up with the transistor. The government stepped in and said, AT&T, you can't have both this incredible new invention and the national phone company. So they spun this off. Shockley took his new invention to California, where he had grown up, and started something that became known as Silicon Valley. So, you know, in this way, government can really spur innovation. Government outright subsidizes things. Yeah. Almost every foot of railroad in this country, including the Transcontinental Railroad, the Transatlantic Cable, the First Telegraph, the Hoover Dam, the Erie Canal, the electronics industry, whole cities such as Los Angeles and Chicago are based on a lot of government subsidies. They set a framework for invention through both things like the TVA, which really provided power to a whole region of the country and transformed life there, and through things like public education. And finally, government picks winners. You have Abraham Lincoln testing the Spencer repeating rifle out on the Washington Mall. Apparently, he was a very good shot, and he decided against the advice of his of some of his generals who didn't like this because they felt it led soldiers to fire too fast. You know, you don't want soldiers firing too rapidly in a battle. So, you know, Lincoln comes up. Lincoln tests this out himself. He says, go with it. It becomes a major factor at the end of the war. Governments will pick winners, whether we like it or not. The question is picking winners as opposed to losers.
Well, let's focus in on some of the inventions that we don't think about much, but that have impacted our everyday lives in really significant ways. I'd like to start with the Otis safety elevator, because that story really brings in not only invention and inventiveness, but a real flair for showmanship.
Yeah, Otis was quite an amazing figure. He was sort of this Job-like figure. He was a tremendously brilliant, inventive man, came out of this New England farm culture, and just went through all the trials of Job. You know, his wife dies, leaving him with these two young sons. He's trying to support them. He invents things and starts mills, and they fail for reasons that are often not his fault. You know, somebody diverts the water supply or something else goes wrong, and he's about to throw it all up and just head west and go look for gold or something he can sell the gold miners, when he hits upon the idea for the safety elevator, which is basically a sort of wagon brake that he adapted and put on an elevator. And this transformed the whole idea of elevators. You'd had elevators for a long time, but making them safe was something else. And he demonstrated this with the help of P.T. Barnum at the Crystal Palace, which was a sort of early World's Fair in New York, imitated the one in London. And they would put on a regular demonstration. He'd get up there in a top hat, Elijah Otis, and he'd have a big saber or sometimes an axe, and he would have himself hoisted up into the air several stories, and it would be announced that the ladies should get out their smelling salts, because who knew what was going to happen then. And he would take this big sword or axe and slash the rope holding the elevator. And, you know, everybody would scream in horror, and the elevator would drop a few feet and stop as his safety brake caught on it. And he would cry out, "All safe, ladies and gentlemen, all safe." And from that, he built an amazing global company, Otis Elevators, and really helped transform our life in ways we don't always expect. This really made possible the skyscraper, which really changed life in the urban U.S.
We're talking with Kevin Baker about his most recent book, which is titled America the Ingenious: How a Nation of Dreamers, Immigrants, and Tinkerers Changed the World. Well, I want to move from the safety elevator to the safety pin, and the inventor of the safety pin was one of those pretty eccentric characters that seem to crop up when you're talking about inventors, Walter Hunt. Who was he?
Walter Hunt was a wonderfully eccentric individual. he was somebody who came from upstate New York to the big city, and all along the way invented one marvelous thing after another, usually well ahead of its time. We're talking about everything from a great repeating rifle to a really good sewing machine to the little wheels on your luggage, the little caster globes, to devices for walking on the ceiling used by circuses that lasted for something like 100 years after his death.
Wow.
Were still in use. Tremendous inventor. And what he specialized in was inventing these things and essentially giving them all away. Yeah, he would invent something, and he would either sell the patent for next to nothing, or at one point he invented this great sewing machine, and his daughter convinced him it would put all these seamstresses out of work. The exact opposite was actually true. It would be a great way of providing employment for many women, but because she objected to it, he never pursued the patent. And what he really looked to make money from was more his dreadful paintings. You know, he painted a lot of paintings of ponies and puppies and things like that, and real estate investments in New York, which he didn't really have the head for. So he'd always end up back in his shop in Abingdon Square down in Greenwich Village trying to invent something else. And at one point he owed all of $15 to somebody who was not pressing him to pay the debt at all, but he was worrying over this, and he went to visit this guy and tell him how sorry he was, and he's fiddling with a bit of wire as he's doing this. And from that, he has this eureka moment, and he goes home and invents the first effective safety pin ever. People have been using pins from back in the Neolithic age. You know, they find them next to the mammoth bones. But here he was. He had finally found a way to make this work, and he does this, and he says, great, and he goes out and sells this to an entrepreneur for $400 on the caveat, with the caveat that he himself pursue getting the patent for this.
Wow.
And he's very happy because he can now settle this $15 debt.
We're talking right now with Kevin Baker, author of America the Ingenious. We're learning about lots of inventions that have improved our lives significantly, but that we may not give much thought to.
And we'll continue this conversation here on Central Time after this short break.
We're continuing our conversation now with historian and author Kevin Baker about his book, America the Ingenious. So it seems like a lot of ingenuity was inspired by the need and desire to make domestic work less of a burden on women. And sometimes women were the ones that came up with the solution. Can you tell us about Josephine Garis Cochran and her dishwasher?
Yes, Josephine Garis Cochran came up with the first dishwasher that really depended on water pressure to clean the dishes instead of scrubbers, which caused a lot less dish breaking. And she really had to sell this invention on her own for years, and she kept being frustrated by the people she would hire to build working models. She said, I couldn't get men to do the things I wanted in my way until they had tried and failed in their own. And that was costly for me. I knew nothing academically about mechanics, and they insisted on having their own way with my invention until they convinced themselves my way was the better. This is so much like men. But she eventually triumphed and won out with her dishwasher. And there were a lot of things women were inventing around the home. You know, there was Catherine Beecher of the remarkable Beecher family, who was the big sort of prophetess of home economics in the 19th century. And she felt women's role really was at the home, but she also felt that was the most important role in society to have. And women needed to really become experts in everything from how to build a house to how to run it, how to take care of farm animals, how to raise kids. And this was reflected in a lot of the invention that went on. So you have women who were, to a great degree, banned from the workplace, of course, and to a great degree not allowed to patent things or had their patents stolen, but inventing all sorts of things on the basis of inventing all sorts of things that were invaluable around the house. For instance, Marion O'Brien Donovan, who comes up with the diaper cover that's tremendously successful. She also came up with the first idea for the disposable diaper, although, you know, men laughed at her, you know, who would need disposable diapers? Well, somebody who's changing all those diapers mm-hmm. knows that that those are needed. So, and then as women, of course, moved into the workplace, they were able to have done very well there too. Everything from the Kevlar vest of Stephanie Louise Kwolek to software engineering on Apollo 11 that was provided by Margaret Heafield Hamilton, who also invented the term software engineering. Mm-hmm. So the minute women were given a chance, they produced tremendous things in every realm. But when they were restricted to the realm of the household, they were very productive there.
Well, and you say in your book that both women and people of color were very yeah. inventive, but one did not have often access to that formal traditional education and then were not allowed to patent their ideas. And often those ideas were taken by white men. Have we seen a large change in how women and people of color are able to get credit for their work?
Yes, we have. We've seen, for instance, women had held something like 1% of all patents about 100 years ago. Today they hold 7%, which of course is a 700-fold mm-hmm. increase.
Still small,
a sevenfold increase, 700% increase, and that's a tremendous thing. It still is not close to what you'd want to see. But it's a tremendous increase once they were allowed to do things, and they were not allowed for many years even to patent things. The oldest invention we have in the book is a sort of corn mill that was invented by Dame Sybilla Masters in 1715, even older than the country. But she was not allowed to get the patent in her own name. She had to do it through her husband. Similarly, Thomas Jennings came up with an early dry cleaning process and got the first patent that we know a black man had in this country. It was a huge outcry at the time because people were saying, all these whites were saying, well, you know, a slave can't have a patent. Of course, he was not a slave. He had been free his entire life, and he used the money he made from this to buy his wife and daughter out of slavery. And his daughter, Elizabeth Jennings, was sort of the Rosa Parks of the North in the 19th century and became this educator, and she was forced off a streetcar for being a black person. She took this to court and won and got the streetcars of New York integrated. So there is a tremendous connection between what people are able to do and bringing this to some greater social good. Another wonderful person we have in there is Madame Demarest, this young woman named Nell Curtis, who came to New York and got married with her husband, started the first real dress pattern business going out all over the country. They also used their magazines selling these dress patterns to be an advocate for women's rights, for the rights of people of color. It was an advocate for abolition against slavery, and they actually had the first real business of that size that was completely integrated and treated their black employees as well as their white employees. So these are steps forward for all of us a lot of the time.
And as we wrap up, Kevin, how would you assess our current time in terms of invention and innovation?
I think it's a tremendous time, and it doesn't always seem like that because there aren't always things as dramatic as, say, the car or the telephone coming out. But I think you'll see the results of things we're not even really that aware are sneaking up on us. The self-driving car will change a tremendous number of things. Nanotechnology, which will give us the space elevator eventually and transform many of the ways in which we live. Gene therapy, prosthetics, replacing parts of the body. These will all transform the way we live. You know, it's a terrific future ahead of us. If we continue to know how to promote invention and to use it wisely.
Kevin, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
That was historian and author Kevin Baker. We spoke with him about his new book, America the Ingenious: How a Nation of Dreamers, Immigrants, and Tinkerers Changed the World.
Wisconsin has also given the world some important inventions. Here's Wisconsin Life executive producer Erica Janik.
The Babcock Butterfat Tester transformed the dairy industry and helped Wisconsin become the dairy state. It's a big story for such a humble object. Wisconsin Historical Museum curator Dave Driscoll shares the story of this transformative invention.
This is a Babcock tester, but it's a very unusual Babcock tester. If you look at it from across the room, it looks like a regular old cheese box. And the way it works is the farmer puts the milk with its proper dilution and additives into the flasks, puts the flasks into the tester, closes the lid, and cranks the handle on the side, which causes the flask to spin around and the butterfat to collect in the necks of the bottles. There are lots of different kinds of Babcock testers that were produced. Most of them are made out of metal. So this is a pretty unprofessional version because it could well be homemade. And the reason for that, I think, has to do with Babcock's approach to the test. In the 1880s, one of the biggest issues facing the dairy industry was how to improve quality. And if you were a creamery, a cheese factory, or a butter maker, it was hard for you to tell which farmers were giving you the best milk. So the question is how to assess the quality of milk. And there were a number of people in Wisconsin working on that. Frederick Short was an agricultural chemist at the University of Wisconsin Agricultural Experiment Station. And one of the many tasks he performed there was to try and determine an effective butterfat test. So Short came up with the idea that if you use some kind of a chemical solvent in a milk sample that would separate the butterfat from the rest of the milk, and then you centrifuged it to concentrate the butterfat, that would be a more expeditious way to do it. He published this in an article, but left before he got a chance to turn it into a workable test. And that task fell to Stephen Babcock, who got most of the credit and got his name on the final test. This was such a significant test that Babcock and the rest of the faculty at the UW decided that it should be shared with everyone. So Babcock declined to patent it. He felt that this was really created for the benefit of the entire industry and that everyone would benefit if this was absolutely freely available. I like this object for two reasons. One is it is so kind of homemade, which I think does connect to that share it with the people idea. I mean, it's kind of an embodiment of the Wisconsin idea in a way. The other thing I like about it is that, in general, the Babcock test story is pretty well known. But this is a very unusual, odd-looking one. This is not your standard Babcock tester. So it kind of tells a different part of the story.
That story is part of Wisconsin 101, a collaborative project to explore our history in objects. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.